This is the Friday Conversation. Joining me in a few moments is Dr. Gerald Chavin. Are you there, Gerald?
I believe I am. If not, I'm still taking the drug from the 60s, I guess.
Well, you know, the thing is that technology these days, I've been out of working in a studio live for, good 2 years now, I suppose. And a lot of things changed in that 2 years. It's amazing. Now, what we're going to be talking about today is about you. And I've titled this series, Who You Didn't Record.
Well, I do know a little bit about me, so maybe that won't be such a bad thing.
Okay, well, look, first of all, just introduce yourselves to the listeners and give us a bit of background and also how you got into this business, because I know that you were on a certain radio station for 24 hours.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Radio Caroline.
Radio. Well, I don't know if you're allowed to say that, but yes. I got into the recording business because I was terribly interested as a kid in music and electronics. And in order to get a job back in the day where there were no word processors, I decided to get the yellow pages with a list of various recording studios in London. Yeah. And what I decided to do was I would, because it took ages to type a letter, I picked the first one and I sent my first letter, Tippex free, actually. I managed to get it
done. Well done.
And I sent it off and I got a reply, believe it or not, within 7 days. And the name of the studio was called AdVision.
Right.
And that was in New Bond Street. And they asked me down for an interview. And much to my surprise, delight, amazement, etc., they said to me, when can you start? I said, well, when do you want me to start? So there was only one kind of caveat as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. I was still studying at college. And I did say to them, look, I do need 1.5 days a week off to continue my studies.
Right.
They were happy to do that, but they wouldn't pay me for those days, okay, which is fair.
Well, I mean, at least they gave you the opportunity to continue your studies, which, of course, is very important.
That's right. So I was able to continue, and I ended up starting work primarily as the tea boy. Yep. I didn't really know how to make tea, but I certainly learned very quickly. And then I graduated from tea boy to what we used to call tape jockey. That's the guy who stood in front of the machine, making sure that nothing really went wrong with it. And
the heads were clean as well and things like that. Make sure the heads were clean and no dust on them.
Absolutely. And when the engineer, the sound engineer said, okay, or pointed to me, because I would just make sure that the thing started up and stopped when it was supposed to, and tried not to catch my fingers in any of the moving parts because that would have been incredibly painful. So that's how I actually started. And then one day our chief engineer, he rang in. We had a big session with, I think it was the Yardbirds. And don't forget, you're talking about a long, long time
ago. Yeah, well, I mean, we're talking at a time when Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton were sort of...
Absolutely. And so... my boss, a guy called Roger Cameron, who unfortunately is no longer with us, he said to me, I'm not going to be able to make it. I've got a terrible cold or the flu or whatever. And I said, well, who are you going to get to replace you? He said, well, I'm talking to him. What? No, and he just graduated. Anyway, I didn't know how everything worked because I had a degree in electronics. So there I am. Straight in at the deep end with it was a record called For Your Love, which was written by the guy who actually wrote the first three hits from the Yardbirds, a guy called Graham Gorman. One of the founders of 10cc, but he was a brilliant songwriter.
He suffered badly from coronavirus. He got through it, I understand, didn't he?
Yeah, I think that's right. But he lives, I think he still lives in Manchester or thereabouts. But he was a genuinely talented songwriter. And then the guitarist, the Yardbirds at that time, because it did keep changing. They've got through guitarists as quickly as most groups get through.
Well, it was a different time, wasn't it? Everybody was absolutely experimenting all the time, I suppose.
Yeah. And it was Jeff, unfortunately, the sadly demised Jeff Beck that played the guitar, which was almost saying played the guitar is not really, I mean, he just kind of amazed us all with his virtuoso skills. And the singer, a guy called Keith Ralph, who again, unfortunately, is no longer with us. He did a great job. And the bass player in the group was a guy called Paul Samuel Smith, who went on to do lots of other things, indeed, including doing the record production for Cat Stevens. And the producer was a guy called, he owned a club called the Crawdaddy Club.
Oh, yes.
Which is famous. He was the original, and I say the original manager, which guy's George O'Gamelski, by the way. He was the original manager of the Rolling Stones, but when Andrew Lou Goldham came along, he kind of gave that up, or he gave him
that's
up.
That's right.
I'm not quite sure the way around it went. But he latched onto the Yardbirds because they were great live. Wow. I mean, live was amazing. And they weren't too bad in the studio either. And that's how I kind of got into doing the very first record. Well, I think For Your Love might have got to like 1, 2, or 3 in the chart.
Hugely successful.
It depends what record paper you read in the day.
I've got to ask you this question. I'm sure listeners are sort of thinking, when you were sort of thrust into this sort of situation where you were going to have to engineer this session, and obviously you must have heard of the Yardbirds, I would imagine, at that time, so you knew who they were. Did you have any sort of feeling? I said, oh my gosh, you know, I'm really sort of throwing it at the deep end here. And did you feel nervous? I suppose you've a little bit sort of cautious about how you dealt with it, but were you just sort of, you just feel grateful to be able to get into the mix and be able to do the job?
I always felt whenever I did any session that if I didn't feel nervous,
there's nothing wrong.
I wasn't going to do a good job, because I think if you just sail into something in a blasé way and you're not really nervous, you're not really giving it your best. Nerves are something that you need to get the old adrenaline going.
Yeah,
the thing that you mustn't do, right, this is general advice, is try not to smoke anything that you shouldn't, or take any pills that you shouldn't, because they actually affect your ears quite bad, amongst other things of you.
Okay, we've got that one out of the way.
Yeah. So, you know, that was the sort of mainstay. And one of the interesting things is that because I understood way that sound works and electronics,
indeed,
all of my peers that are still around, they're all pretty deaf, right? Most of them, you know, you have to say things to them 2 or 3 times.
Yeah, I have that problem a bit, I'll be honest with you.
Right, well, it's because the speakers were so loud, and I always believed you needed to keep the speakers at a reasonable level, because nobody in the real world that bought the stuff was going to be listening to it that loudly.
I blame AirPods, though, today.
Well, yeah, but it's a different era.
Indeed.
But we a little while after that, we had in a band that is probably renowned for being the loudest, certainly back in those days. And our studio, as I said before, was in New Bond Street. And we were obviously in the basement.
Yep.
And above us was a very, very posh menswear shop.
Really?
Very posh. And this group was so loud that the manager of the menswear shop came down and said to me, "We can hear the music coming into the shop." And I thought, oh my God. So I said to him,
"It must have been loud.
Would you like free tickets to see The Who?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, don't say anything else." So it was The Who, obviously.
Was this Magic Bus? Was it Magic Bus you worked on, wasn't it?
I don't remember, but we did quite a lot, and dogs, stuff like that. And I went into the studio, which was the biggest mistake I could have made. And I said, "Any chance of you guys turning it down a bit?" Because the second off. But when we were doing an overdub, because obviously we record the backing tracks and then we had a vocal booth, like most studios, Roger and Pete, Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend were in the vocal booth. And, you know, I was playing the backing track and sitting in front of the console, and I couldn't hear them. And I thought, what's going on? So I went into the booth and I said, look, I've had a bit of a problem with the sound here. And I checked all the microphones, checked everything, and nothing. I couldn't hear anything. And it turned out, after I twigged it, that because I sort of told them to play quieter, they decided to mine. Which,
brilliant. Yeah,
sort of served me right, I guess. But we used to go to a pub around the corner from the studio, a 5-minute walk away. And the guy, the landlord of the pub, because I used to bring everybody that was famous, really.
Who would drink a lot.
I didn't have to pay.
That's a good point as well.
We went there for, I don't know, a drink or something to eat. And I knew what was happening.
Got banned, did you?
Well, Keith Moon and Pete Townsend fighting. And, you know, one of them, I can't remember which one, threw a pint of beer over the other one. And the landlord, who was a big guy, he said to him, that's it. He said, you're banned. Not you, Gerald. So it wasn't just, you know, sort of like a regular job where you know, you have to go to work from 9 to 5.
Wonderful stories. Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Dr. Gerald Chevin, and we're talking to him about the bands that he didn't record. In fact, that he has got such a plethora of incredible stories. Let's have a little break, Gerald. Let's listen to that Yardbirds track, which kind of set the whole thing off for you all those years ago, and we'll come back and just have a little general chat and play something else. And also, we'll talk about your jingle. Say, Gerald Chevin, he even has his own jingle, and there you heard it. Give us a bit of background on how that came about, Gerald.
Okay, well, I was working with a guy called Barry Mason, who people may know was a songwriter for lots of major tunes.
Controversial Jones, Delilah, he wrote.
Oh, it is now, it wasn't then.
Well, I mean, now it is, yeah.
Yeah, and this guy, Paul Samuel Smith, and, mm-hmm. you know, we always used to start fairly late. I mean, it wasn't a 9-to-5 job because musicians are not artistic, apparently, between the hours of 9 and 5. They get artistic about 9 o'clock in the evening.
Been there, done that. So
so here we are. It's now 3 o'clock in the morning, and this band decided to just play a kind of jazzy thing, but they wanted to come up with some kind of a voiceover thing, and nobody could think of anything to do. I was absolutely shattered because I wanted to go home. It's like 3:30 in the morning and I had to be back at 8. So I just tossed off the line. I said, you know, how about calling it, you know, or singing I Love Gerald Chevin the Great? And I thought it was a brilliant idea. And, you know, we did it. And then I actually managed to get home, get some sleep. And before I knew it, I was back in the studio the next morning. So that's the way that turned out.
I suppose in a nutshell, I mean, you worked in AdVision. You worked at AdVision. I think they also did a lot of TV commercials and at the time, didn't they?
Yeah, very much.
Made
so.
The name we AdVision jingles, was.
We did TV themes from the Avengers, if you remember the original Marvel Avengers theme.
Yeah, brilliant.
And the guy called Laurie Johnson was composer. And he said to me and my boss, he said, would you two like to come to Elstree and watch some film, The Avengers?
Wow.
Oh, you know, why wouldn't we? So, and this is when Diana Rigg was in it. Well, we get there at, I don't know, 9 or 10 in the morning. And basically, everyone just sits around all day.
That's movie making.
And it's like really boring. And we looked at each other, we wouldn't like to do this. And after about 5 hours, Diana Rigg walked on the stage. And it made everything work. We'd have spent another 20 hours waiting because she was way more attractive than she was on the screen in real life. She was just an incredible person. So, you know, we did a lot of jingles. We did a lot of ads, because in those days with commercial radio, the person that was the announcer had to have a voice that you knew who it was having to say it's this. So it was like Kenneth Williams, Sid James, people like that, even Orson Welles. And we when Sid James came in, we did an advert for petrol or something, or paraffin. Not Sid James, sorry, Kenneth Williams.
Honestly,
we couldn't. Nobody could keep a straight face. We could hardly work any of the controls because without saying anything funny, he was just funny. And it was really, really hard to concentrate on doing what we were supposed to do. But it was great to meet all these people. We really, you know, it was a fantastic life. And at the beginning of it all, I used to sort of, you know, come home and tell people, oh, today I've just met XYZ. And, after a while, XYZ was like part of my
daily routine.
and it didn't quite mean as much, but I do realize now, in retrospect, how lucky I was to be able to be involved, A, with primarily the music of the day, which I still believe the 60s music is king, and famous people, and it was really enjoyable.
Well, I met sort of just like Hattie Jakes. I worked with a lot of big names in recording for TV and radio commercials. I was a bit later on, sort of in the late 70s, when I was working in London down Wardour Street, down Fleet Street, and after a while, you just sort of get used to sort of somebody coming in who you know, who's a name, and you just get on with the job. I had to spend a 3-hour session with Tom Baker recording something for BASF, and we learned how to pronounce Balisa Alaline Stodafabriken. I've never forgotten. I don't think he has either. But you forget about the personality or the celebrity, and you just do the job. But you still have great fun in doing it, don't you?
Oh, yeah, and you know, you were taken aback initially. I mean, we did these, I think, the Sherry adverts with Orson Welles, and
he was a laugh character.
In real life, on the microphone, in every way, and one of the most incredibly talented people overall that I've ever come across. And his voice was unmistakable, absolutely unmistakable. And this is what you needed when you were doing these things. You didn't want someone to say, hello, I'm so-and-so. Once you've done that, you've already failed.
Yes. Yes, no, it was the celebrity in the voice and the sound. I mean, and of course, we don't realize just how significant that was back in the day. In fact, now, as we well know, film actors would never go near doing commercials, but now they're doing them all the time, aren't they? George Clooney appears doing coffee commercials, but it's now considered a done thing because a name on the screen for a TV commercial sells the product.
And it helps them buy their next swimming pool or something. So, yeah.
Or the new villa. Getting back to your time then with the artists back in the day, I just want to ask you something. When you started to do recordings and you walked into the first time you walked into Advertin Studio, and you obviously with an engineering degree, you understood the technical side of the equipment. Was there anything that you sort of really felt, I really do need to spend time learning about this? Because I'm just being a little bit anorakish here and saying, because I know, how it generally it works, but there's always something that you feel as you've got to spend a bit more time on understanding.
Well, in those days, editing tapes was a physical process.
Absolutely.
A razor blade and special Scotch tape.
Yeah, fingers full of calluses after a few days.
Yeah, and if you messed it up, you could destroy the recording. So basically, that was something that we had to practice. It's probably like a surgeon doing stitches on somebody. I mean, if you mess it up in real life with a surgeon, somebody dies. But it's kind of important not to mess the music up. So
sure.
Not quite as serious, but it, to the artist, it's very serious. So we had to learn how to do that. That was probably because in real life, I'd never done that before.
Right.
So it was fortunate that I could read music so that when we did large orchestras, I could follow the score. And quite a lot of the artists, you know, the pop artists, couldn't read a note of me. But they did everything, you know, basically by listening, using their ears.
That really did sort of actually answer a big question, because yes, it was a very, very important factor of working in a recording studio or working sort of post-production doing commercials as well. I remember my fingers were just sort of so dry and full of calluses for days and days and days after I'd been in a particularly sort of heavy session where I had to do a heck of a lot of editing. You actually had to edit a track, didn't you? Word by word, I think you told me.
Well, we had a lot of people in those days that they thought that what they could do was, if the record was successful in the UK, perhaps they could do it in Italy or France or whatever, but they had to re-record the song.
Okay.
And lots of these artists couldn't obviously pronounce anything. So we would literally record one word at a time, and providing they get it right. And then we had to join everything together. And it was very laborious, not for them, but for me. And of course, there was a translator there to make sure that they'd said the words correctly, because I mean, I wouldn't know. Once, in fact, I had to do we did a lot of radio shows, funnily enough. And I did one once, and I thought it was a joke. Bloke comes in, he says, right, we're doing this radio show. Unfortunately, it's going to be in Swahili. So I said, what? And I'm supposed to edit this thing in Swahili? I mean, you know, anyway, somehow or other, I mean, I really can't remember how. Apparently, not that I would ever know, apparently it came out okay, but I've only got the guy's word for it, because to me it was just gobbledygook. But so, yeah, you do get to do some pretty strange things, or I did get to do some pretty strange things. But most of the music stuff was just a journey, a lovely journey, which I was able to explore and sort of take in and appreciate everything that was going on. And unlike a lot of my peers who obviously were not in the music business in any way, shape or form, I could record something back in the day. One of the tracks, the biggest things I ever did was Procol Harum, White a Shade of Pale.
Indeed, yeah,
And here it is 50 odd years later, people can listen to it and appreciate it. But, you know, my peers who were accountants, nobody would ever say to them 50 years
great,
later.
A great audit you did there.
50 years ago, that was amazing. You know, there is that. So there is a kind of a...
You've got a legacy. You've got a legacy, Gerald. That's the thing. It's a legacy.
And that makes me very happy.
Absolutely.
You know, long after I'm gone, the music, well, Gary Brooker, unfortunately, the singer from Procol, is gone. And again, there are less and less people around from that era. And because it's a long time ago, I was very, very young, and I was virtually the youngest person to be in the studio most of the time, including the groups and everybody else. So I was lucky that I was young enough to A, remember it in the way I remembered it, and B, to still be here to remember it.
Indeed. Gerald, I want to, I would love to continue talking. This is why we're going to do a few of these sessions over the coming weeks, because we're going to actually talk about specific artists that you work with. And I was going to talk to you about Jerry Rafferty and the album Can I Have My Money Back. We're going to play a track before the end of the hour. Just to let our listeners know that you have been working on a book, which is presumably going to be published this year?
Yes. In fact, I'm talking to my editor this evening. My editor's in Laurel Canyon, which is you may know, in California. And we just I finished writing it. I'm just waiting to get the best publishing deal I can.
Absolutely.
The title of the book, because of the song I just mentioned, it's called A Whiter Shade of Sound. Which is a
very clever play on words. So we know the title of the book, and we'll be talking about your career in the coming weeks. So thanks so much for joining us today. And so we're going to play a piece of music at the end of this hour, and we'll talk next week about Joe Rafferty. David Bowie, you did the Man Who Sold the World album. We're going to talk about that, and we'll have some music from The Who as well, and we'll talk a little bit more in detail about that. And of course, your remarkable time you spent building Richard Branson's studio, which, of course, after which he asked you to stay and engineer Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells.
Yeah, well, I was the only one who knew how it worked.
On that note...
Anyway, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, and I look forward to our next session.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Daryl Chavin, for joining us here at Talk Radio. Take care. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.